I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE, key member of the energy alliance OPEC with the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. Venezuela, with the greatest known oil reserves in the world, just celebrated Independence Day, despite being targeted by NATO nations with coups, sanctions, starvation and terrorism for refusing to be a Washington vassal state. Later this month, it faces presidential elections. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department, mired in supporting a proxy war through Ukraine and genocide in Gaza, in maybe the dying days of the Biden regime, has just announced it will participate in talks the day after tomorrow with President Maduro's government in Venezuela. In the new book, Corporate Coup, Venezuela and the End of U.S. Empire, the Grey Zone's Anya Parampil draws on her own investigations and revelations from Julian Assange's WikiLeaks. Anya joins me now from Northern Virginia. Anya, thanks so much for coming on Going Underground. Finally, I'm not sure whether you've been on before, an amazing book. And before we get on to the brilliant book that everyone needs to read, even if they're not interested in Venezuela, we had Julian Assange's brother, Gabriel Shipton, on Going Underground on Saturday's episode. Your book references WikiLeaks many times. Epigraph is from Julian. Why had you told Gabriel Shipton that you didn't expect Julian to be extradited to Virginia, where you've just moved to?
Yes, I did actually see him about, I guess, almost 2 months ago when he was meeting with U.S. officials hoping to get some sort of deal through, which fortunately came to fruition in the last few weeks, and told him that deep down in my heart, I didn't believe the U.S. political class, the elite that has been split between wanting to drone bomb or draw out this persecution of Assange, and the fear that actually bringing him here would ignite even more of a pro-free speech and pro-Assange movement in the United States. I know that people like yourself and high-profile journalists all across the world have acted as a voice for Assange and an advocate for him during this time. But from the perspective of a U.S. citizen, what I witnessed over the last years as he languished in Belmarsh was the emergence of a movement of just average U.S. people all across, mainly in New York and Washington, who would make their presence known at powerful institutions such as the Biden Justice Department or the Trump Justice Department, for that matter, camping outside of the DOJ. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, they actually had a birthday party for Julian outside and said that we're here cutting cake in his honor to tell the U.S. Justice Department that we have a constitution here. We have a First Amendment right to free speech. And I know people also in New York who every Thursday, Bernadette and Chuck, these activists would actually go to the New York Times office and pass out flyers about Assange's case, put pressure on the journalists that actually depend on this constitution and this right to free speech to do their own work and make the case that the continued persecution of Assange would be damaging to them as well. And I do believe that if Assange came here, it would not only invigorate that group, which would have a presence outside of the prison and his courtroom, and ultimately gain media attention. I do believe that if the actual step of taking him, bringing him here to the United States had occurred, that it would force even mainstream pundits and mainstream newspapers to begin a discussion about free speech and our rights, our constitutional rights in this country, that frankly, I don't think the political establishment were prepared for. They would have much rather, I think, prolonged his imprisonment in Belmarsh for as long as they could and let that be the punishment, because they might have to deal with their own public if that trial were to have actually gone through.
Yeah, you mentioned drone bomb. Of course, they did get close, though, to killing Julian Assange. The CIA, the UK, the New York Times, arguably. That's what Niels Meltzer, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, told our program. They were collaborators with CNN and The Guardian in this. Of course, you are at the Grey Zone, and the founder of the Grey Zone, Max, told us it's being targeted. So what does the Assange case mean, and the deal he made to save his life, mean for you and your sources at the Grey Zone?
The precedent that this guilty plea sets is definitely concerning for any journalist, because What Julian did is something that all journalists do, collect information from sources and ask for more. So it is not something that I expect, though, to have a chilling effect in the work that we do, because if anything, Julian's example has only served to make all of us stronger. He's such an inspiration for me personally. That's why I put that epigraph in the book, that quote from his, "If wars can be started by lies, peace can be started by truth." And I think that that is the mentality and that all journalists should have, and that's the symbol that he's come to represent through his persecution, and that journalists like myself, Max, Aaron, Kit, Wyatt, others at the Gray Zone and all throughout the United States look to Julian and look to WikiLeaks as an example and look to WikiLeaks as a source. Something that I just want to emphasize is that much of the reporting in my book depended on WikiLeaks files. For example, the NGO unit, the global network run by OATPOR and the National Endowment for Democracy, these groups that kind of create seemingly grassroots organizations that are actually fronts for the U.S. State Department and regime change, act as regime change outfits worldwide. We know about the inner workings of those groups because of WikiLeaks, because of the State Department cables, because of the Stratfor leaks that described these activists, including those in Venezuela that are dealt with in my book, as basically running around the world and overthrowing governments that the U.S. doesn't like. And those are direct quotes that we may have known that to be true just from reporting and what we suspected to be true about these groups. But we have quotes and hard evidence of so much because of what WikiLeaks provided us years ago. It's really a trove and a gift that keeps on giving.
We can't do without it here. In the book, you compare Julian's assassination, the attempted assassinations on Julian Assange, to the case of Alex Saab. Just tell us who Alex Saab is. I understand in the past few weeks he's been appointed to Maduro of Venezuela, President Maduro's investment ministry.
Yes, Alex Saab is a Venezuelan diplomat. He's Colombian-born, but early on in the Chavista revolution, while the rest of Colombia's business sector was boycotting Venezuela, essentially, he saw an opportunity and became very close with the government and ultimately ended up winning major contracts to build public housing in Venezuela and then also to provide supplies for the CLAP food program. This is a program that I've witnessed firsthand in Venezuela and is really something that's credited with having curbed the effects of U.S. sanctions. At the height of U.S. sanctions, or the effects of the Obama administration's national security declaration saying that Venezuela was a national security threat.
Sorry to interrupt. Obama tried to starve the population of Venezuela, millions, tens of millions of people.
Absolutely, tried to kill them. Because that decision immediately cut the Venezuelan private sector and state off from international credit lines and made it very difficult for international shipping companies to go to Venezuela. So there were incredible shortages. People were starving at that time. And so the government actually initiated a program to deliver subsidized food and housing supplies to millions of families across the country. And it tasked Alex Saab, this businessman, with traveling around the world to Turkey and elsewhere to supply products for these boxes. I've seen, for example, Turkish pasta and oil, cooking oil, arrive in these boxes at the homes of Venezuelans when I was staying there. And according to an opposition allied economist that I cite in the book, this program really prevented mass famine and starvation in Venezuela. It was a direct intervention in the economy that the Maduro government made in order to basically mitigate the effects of sanctions in this hybrid economic war. And so the United States was not very happy with Alex Saab and this program. They at Elliot Abrams, the Trump Venezuela envoy, would basically criticize it as an oil for food program or a bribery program to get Venezuelans to vote for the Maduro government.
Elliot Abrams, a war criminal in El Salvador for the El Mazote massacre.
Yes, indeed. Who and main character in the Iran-Contra affair, who for some reason ended up running both Venezuela and Iran policy for Trump. Not the best candidate for that job, but I guess it also revealed the criminal nature of the U.S. deep state through his presence in that administration. But so as part of their war on the Venezuelan people and effort to starve them, the U.S. government eventually cooked up a case, an indictment against Alex Saab, just as they did with Julian Assange. You remember his indictment was kept secret until he was actually in custody where he could be transferred to the United States. And that's what happened with Alex Saab. He was on a trip one day to Iran and stopped to fuel his plane in Cape Verde on the African coast, the West African coast. All because the U.S. and Mike Pompeo, Trump's Secretary of State, writes about this in his memoir, had gotten an idea, a word that Saab was going to be landing there. They immediately pressured the government in Praia, in the capital of Cape Verde, to arrest Alex Saab. Even though there was no indictment that he was aware of, there was not even an Interpol warrant. In fact, the ECOWAS court, the court of the region of West Africa, ultimately determined that the Interpol red notice that was used in order to justify his arrest was actually issued after his detention. So the reason that this case compares to Julian's is because not only is this an example of the United States keeping an indictment secret and then them pouncing on a subject once they saw the opportunity, but more importantly, it shows that the U.S. security state views its jurisdiction as applying to the entire planet. You know, there's actually not even there was not an existing extradition treaty between the United States and Cape Verde, but through pressure, including outright bribery, such as signing multi-million dollar investment in economic investment packages with the government in Cape Verde, and also investing millions of dollars in a revamp of the U.S. embassy in the capital there, the government ultimately agreed to extradite Saab to the United States. And he did spend a little over a year, about a year and a half, in a Miami prison cell awaiting trial. But once they got him here, most of the money laundering charges that they had initially set against him were thrown out. And the case ultimately fell apart. And Saab was traded in a prisoner swap, and now he's back in Venezuela and I guess wasted no time getting back to work. But it was a lesson, because not only should international law, in the sense that the U.S. jurisdiction doesn't apply to Cape Verde, they can't just go in there and arrest somebody where U.S. authorities don't technically have a jurisdiction, but it showed that even diplomatic immunity went out the door when it serves the United States, because Alex Saab was a diplomat. So even if he was guilty of the crimes that they alleged, they had no authority, no right to go after him in the way they did, just as they had no right to go after Julian Assange.
Annie Pimple, I'll stop you there. More from the Grey Zone journalist and author of Corporate Coup, Venezuela and the End of U.S. Empire, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the Grey Zone's Anya Parampil, author of Corporate Coup, Venezuela and the End of U.S. Empire. Anya, in part one, you were telling me about Trump officials, some of them accused of aiding genocide in their previous incarnations in previous administrations. Oliver Stone, Roger Waters, they endorsed your book. Tucker Carlson endorsed your book. You talk about how you were on his Fox News show, and Donald Trump watched that episode of Tucker Carlson where you explained what was really going on with the secret state, deep state's actions under the Trump administration against Venezuela. Do you think Trump, too, if he's elected in November, will understand that he was being used to destroy Venezuela for other reasons?
I think that Trump's instincts on Venezuela and Maduro are actually correct, based on what I read in the memoirs of Trump administration officials. Particularly John Bolton writes about how Trump on multiple occasions would ask to meet with President Maduro and resolve the problem, the crisis with Venezuela directly, and that he was actually skeptical about Juan Guaido, didn't want to issue the initial recognition of Guaido as president under his name, but was ultimately convinced to do so by Mike Pence, who held a phone call with Guaido the night before and was apparently taken by him. And Bolton, for whatever reason, was present for that phone call and really driving this coup policy. But Bolton complains that Trump kind of just wanted to settle this, and he kind of saw Maduro as acting as a tough cookie. Those were the words that the Washington Post, I believe, put out there around the same time that Tucker had that conversation with me that I also write about in the book, during which Trump told him that he understood that Bolton was crazy on Venezuela, and that if he listened to him on everything, he would be in World Wars 1, 2, and 3. The issue is that, like when it comes to Israel, for example, in the United States, policy isn't necessarily set according to the interests of Americans or this country, but a small special interest group, a lobby. And the Cuba-Venezuela exile lobby, which is very prevalent and profound in Florida, is extremely powerful, because Florida is a state that any U.S. president has to win. It's one of the major battleground states. And the population there, made up of people that have fled the revolutions in Cuba and Venezuela over the years, and other progressive governments across the region, they've settled in Florida, and they've created a base of influence where this is their number one issue. They want to use essentially the U.S. government as muscle in order to regain power back in their own countries, because they're the elite that were replaced by these revolutions. And that group is very powerful in the Republican Party and on the Democratic side as well in Florida. And so I can't maintain a lot of confidence that the president, regardless, not even Joe Biden has been willing to reverse this coup decision and reverse the recognition of Guaido, even while engaging in direct talks with the Venezuelan government, because it is just a hot political issue.
Actually, just on Biden there, sorry to interrupt. John Bolton's actually been on this show where he said he tried desperately to and successfully to dissuade Trump from having that meeting with Maduro. I've just got to quickly ask, actually, as well, aside from your book, is what do you make of Bolivia? Because Luis Arce was on this show, and I was kind of surprised when the president of Bolivia didn't really respond to my questions about MI6 and the Reuters news agency and British involvement in trying to destroy democracy in Bolivia. We all carry Bolivia with us in our mobile phones, of course, with the lithium. Evo Morales is now fighting with Luis Arce. Evo Morales, the inspiration behind a change in Bolivia. Is that true? Biden behind this?
That is what I've heard. That is what I have heard from my contacts in Bolivia, and people that were very confused by how this coup played out. What was it, about 2 weeks ago now? It was a very short-lived coup. Someone tweeted at me that they had ordered a pizza, and by the time it came out of the oven, the coup was over. And yeah, that was pretty much how it played out. But I also wasn't surprised that it fizzled out so quickly, because I was in Bolivia in 2020, the end of 2020, in the midst of the last military, actually, coup occupation. There was a coup in 2019 that violently ousted Evo Morales from power after he won re-election. And a military junta was installed that was, they loved to show their force in the street the night before. And basically, they tried to delay a vote. They initially said that their military government was an interim government. But because Bolivians across the country are actually armed and threatened to go on strike and push even toward a possible civil war without a vote, even that military junta was forced to hold an election. And that is how Arce won and came back into power. And so what I learned there is, aside from the politics, of course, that there's always infighting in political parties, people struggling for power and authority. And I see that that is underway in mass right now. There is obviously tension between the Arce faction and the Morales faction, but that what you can count on with Bolivia is that the people are not going to tolerate a foreign backed coup or...
But Anya, is there shades of Ecuador? Like Correa promoted a protege like Lenin Moreno who turned out to be a CIA asset. The man I spoke to, the president of Bolivia, you know, we don't know yet, basically, whether he's an asset of the Biden administration.
We don't know, but it's always tough, I suppose, when you're dealing with the economists or financial actors in your administration. And that is, of course, what Arce was. He was the economy minister under Morales. And sometimes those people are more connected to international finance or foreign interests than someone coming out of other ministries in the government.
Well, we invite President Arce to come back on the show. In the book, you talk about a very important music figure, actually, in my childhood. He was signed the Sex Pistols with his parents' money, Richard Branson. That made headlines all around the world. Virgin founder Richard Branson with his bizarre concert. Just tell me about the influence, an attempted influence of Richard Branson on trying to sponsor, well, if you read your book, I mean, in effect, he's helping to catalyze mass starvation and death in Venezuela.
Yeah, he was the cultural element in this corporate coup. This was in February of 2019, just a month after the Trump administration announced its recognition of Guaido, this shadow government in Venezuela. And part of the threat that came down afterwards were, for a while, and I was in Venezuela at the time, it seemed as if actual war between the U.S. and Venezuela could break out, because the United States, citing the humanitarian crisis in the country that the U.S. government had actually exacerbated through its sanctions policy and driven through its sanctions policy, and I think I make that case pretty clearly in the book, why U.S. sanctions and financial policy are to blame for Venezuela's crisis, didn't prevent the U.S. from, yes, turning around and saying, because of the starving Venezuelans, we're going to compile all this humanitarian aid on the border in Colombia. And because Maduro is such an evil dictator who will not accept foreign aid, not even from Elliot Abrams, the man known to have smuggled weapons to the the Contras during the war against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, through humanitarian aid shipments. That was actually his strategy decades prior in the region. So Maduro is such an evil dictator, he won't accept our aid, so we're going to push it across the border with U.S. military trucks. And this was a very tense time when the U.S. military had a presence all across Venezuela's border with Colombia. And it would have just ended there if not for Richard Branson. He made it a much bigger cultural and international event by holding this concert in Cucuta, in one of the poorest regions of Colombia, actually, where people were quite in need of humanitarian aid themselves. It just happened to be a U.S. ally state, so nobody cared. And he convened this massive stadium or stage and paid for major artists from South America to perform there for what I kind of say was like a Coachella for the U.S.'s regional instruments, their tools. All of the U.S. allied presidents in the region and Luis Almagro, then Secretary General of the Organization of American States, all came to this concert. And it got coverage in Rolling Stone and Billboard magazine and all of these newspapers that probably would have paid no attention to the situation in Venezuela if not for Branson's act there. But it didn't come without criticism. Roger Waters did a great job mocking Branson at the time, basically saying this billionaire doesn't actually care about anybody. He's just essentially acting as a tool of U.S. and transatlantic hegemony and empire there.
The book is full of bizarre Luis Almagro, as you say, who was a former Honduran minister, strange turnarounds, Michel Bachelet, a hero during the U.S.-backed dictatorship in Chile, strange turnarounds. We don't really understand why. The culpability you run in your book is between Boris Johnson, Moody's agency, Univision, the mouthpieces at CNN, BBC, Reuters, Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg. Yeah, people have to read the book to see the whole list. But I just want to finally say why you say in the book that Putin's belated move to save the people of Donetsk was somehow decisive in saving Venezuelans. What on earth has a war in Europe costing hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians got to do with the saving of lives in Venezuela?
This is a very clear illustration of the follies of U.S. imperial overconfidence, because under Trump, in order to pressure the Venezuelan people into recognizing its shadow government that the U.S. had installed, Juan Guaido, Trump actually banned the sale of Venezuelan oil in U.S. markets. And this was a relationship that had gone back almost a century since the discovery of Venezuelan oil. We've had entire pipelines and an infrastructure built, oil refineries here, in order to pump Venezuelan oil into U.S. gas stations. And at the time, Venezuela was supplying roughly 7% of U.S. oil imports. And overnight, when that ban came down, Russia's share of the U.S. oil import market jumped 7%. And I show that graph in my book. It's inverse. So the suggestion there to me is that Russia was perhaps buying the Venezuelan oil and selling it back to us, which is a ridiculous example of how our policy fails. But even if they weren't, they were selling us about 10% of our imports when Biden, Joe Biden, came along and decided in 2022, after the special military operation was launched in Ukraine, that, and then Trump, Biden decided to issue his own embargo of oil, this time against Russia. And so within just a few years, the U.S. government had cut off itself. And I say that's why I argue these sanctions are basically sanctions on U.S. citizens, because it just resulted in our oil prices skyrocketing, which resulted in inflation all over, because oil price dictates the price of everything. And so Biden panicked and actually went on to Venezuela, sent a team there to begin direct talks with the Maduro government. And as I said, even though they haven't reversed the decision to recognize a fake government in Venezuela, they did begin easing some sanctions, which now they slap back when they feel like it for political reasons.
Well, that's something to watch out for anyway at the negotiations on Wednesday. We'll have to have you back as the story continues and it influences perhaps November's election. Who knows? Anya Parable, thank you.
Thank you, Afshin.
And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by UK-US-EU armed genocide. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.